past week, this article came out in the paper. I cut it out, put it on there. It's the only way I can get it on there. If you look down in the third paragraph, that's a paragraph that applies to you. It has to do with the law. Now, here is a Buren Pentecostal Church pastor, it said, said he was not surprised the state Supreme Court overthrew his conviction for failing to report incidents of child abuse disclosed to him during counseling in sessions 1985. So, second paragraph skip, he said he wasn't worried about it. I would have been. But the third one, the court's unanimous decision relieved ordained clergy of the obligation to report cases of suspected child abuse, but it maintained, here it is, that obligation for lay religious counselors. Now, I know we don't have laity and clergy, but in the government, you'll find out in court they do. And so if you are counseling, before you are appointed as an elder. Now, I don't know on this what they would consider an elder, because when they talk about ordained, they're generally talking about preachers. It's what they're talking about, preachers being ordained. And in the eyes of the government, a pastor is over the elders. So you got to read the article with that idea in mind. Now, from their viewpoint, let's take this congregation. I would be exempt. I would not have to report that. And the reason that they say it is because people would come in and talk to me on a basis of secrecy and wanting to know what to do and so forth. And so I find out a lot of secrets. And if I'm going to have to tell these secrets, then people are not going to come in, see, to talk with me. So in order to encourage people to seek help, well, then they have relieved what they call the ordained clergy, which I didn't receive an ordination the way they talk about it, but they would consider me as one of those fellows, so that people would come in and talk. But now, I don't know how they look at Bud and Steve. You see, the other two elders. I know that they would look at them as under me because they would look at the preacher really as the pastor. That's the way you would be judged, is what I'm saying. But in your counseling before you're appointed as an elder, why, that would be very, very important to keep in mind, that you would not be cleared unless you did report that. That's where, in counseling, where it's touchy, very touchy. There was a little girl babysitter, babysitting a little 2-year-old and of her relatives, and so he brought her in and said, I think, you know, that they're child abuse here or something, and so pulled down her diaper, and the little blue mark, the size of the lead in a pencil or something, you know, maybe a quarter of an inch long, just a small little blue mark there. Obviously, I mean, I suppose all of us have left blue marks on our kids, haven't we? As we've spanked them, you look at it, you say, you know, what does it show? Now, of course, what you have to do is interpret that in today's culture, really, and you've got to go about it in two ways. That if there is evidence, then you need to report it. You need to deal with it, but if there's not evidence, then in doing that, think of how much trouble that I could get you into if I reported it and you're not spanking your child. Maybe the child did fall against something, or maybe you spanked the child and left one little blue mark on there. And they don't fool around with it. Boy, they're really tough on child abuse. And I want them to be tough on child abuse. But as they're tough on child abuse, it can affect honest parents who are trying to control their children, see. And so We're living in a society of where you really have to wrestle with that, and it's a real touchy thing. And so, if you go to if a parent goes to a regular counselor, and he would see that, he would have to report it. Anything that comes up, he would have to report it, and that's a touchy thing. Okay, any question? Yeah.
I think a lot of these people that are reporting child abuse, for example, at your schools, the teachers and people in the schools, they don't know what child abuse is.
Right.
I mean, they don't have the slightest idea.
Right.
They say this kid acts funny today, so his parents must be beating him or something. And,
right.
And then they call it in, you know, but it's mm-hmm. not the case at all.
That's the problem. But that's the society we're living in. And so you have to wrestle with that.
But once it's reported, then it's your obligation to prove it isn't.
That's right. You have to prove it isn't. And I'm telling you, there's problems. I mean, and they stay for a long time in there. And it's strictly up to you to do that, to prove that you're innocent. So we're living in a time of when it's good and it's bad. It's good that child abuse has been brought out to the forefront and that things are being done about it. And I'm for it 100%. Little children, many of them are just beaten and banged around and abused terribly. And people get by with it.
Some of them die.
That's right. So it has to be dealt with. But as we as human beings, in what area do we not swing all the way? We always swing all the way to that. So we're living in that particular situation right now. Child molestation, you know, the sexual molestation, little girls. You hear it all the time. You know, it's coming out now more and more all the time. And it's good that they're told, you know, and the little girls are told to report everything and do all of this. That is great. And it's revealed a lot of things that's been going on. And I can't think of a more hideous crime than a man that would do something of that nature. But on the other hand, it makes you afraid to pick up a little girl, doesn't it? You know, I mean, out here, little girls will run up to me. Lyle's little girl, you know, run up to me, and I give her hugs and kisses, but every time I do it, I want to make sure Lyle or somebody's around, you know, see me. I give her a hug and a kiss like that. And a few years ago, you know, well, you wouldn't think anything about it, you know, in doing that. But so it's good, but you have to remember the society in which you're living. And what we try to get is perfection, but we don't have it. It's just that simple. In our last class, we were talking about when to give advice, and we talking about various things there, and I just wrote down a couple of notes right here that I want to talk about just a little bit before we turn to the thing that we really want to discuss tonight. That is, first of all, in Proverbs chapter 8 and in verse 14. Here is a verse that you might mark and keep in mind. Proverbs 8, verse 14. Counsel is mine and sound knowledge. I am understanding. Now, this is wisdom talking, by the way. Wisdom is pictured as a beautiful woman who invites all men to come to her and enjoy what she can give to them. And what she gives to them is all pure and righteousness and wisdom. And it's prudence and riches and honor and various things. She invites you to come and get from her what this beautiful woman can give you. Then she will compare herself to a harlot, of what the harlot then offers. Momentary pleasure, you turn into her and you ruin your life. And so that's what the first 9 chapters really are about. So here is Mrs. Wisdom talking. If you could think about wisdom then, stating this. And so wisdom says, counsel is mine. In other words, I give counsel, I give advice, and all counsel would have to come out of the mind of wisdom. You'd have to have wisdom to do it. So counsel is mine and sound knowledge. I am understanding. I have might. That is, I have power. And I want us to think about that when we're talking about helping people and counseling people, and take this business very, very seriously. Now, suppose I were to tell you that next semester I'm going to teach a course on how to take out appendix. what would your reaction be? Now you say, how much experience you had? Not much. You know, I saw one taken out one time. And we're going to get in here and we'll experiment on a couple of these guys. And, you know, I'm going to teach you. Now, you'd call me a fool, wouldn't you? See? And you'd say, you're going to do so much damage, see, that you just can't believe what you're getting ready to do, Lowell. You see, in this. Why? Because there's a lot of might. There's a lot of power in a knife. And when you start cutting on a human body, what can you do to that human body? Well, on the other hand, is there a lot of power in the knife in a skilled surgeon's hand? See, in an individual that knows what he's doing, there's a lot of power that is in there. Now, as we're dealing with the human mind and human lives, and we're giving counsel, there's a lot of power there. There's more power than any of us will ever realize. Now, I'm saying this to you because I forget it. And once in a while, a statement will be made to me that will just be absolutely shocking to me. And there'll be somebody come up to me and say, you know, you remember when I came in and talked to you? Now, everybody thinks that you remember everything they told you, see? And as I told you, I don't. You know what I mean? I just don't remember. So, but I hate to say, oh, no, I don't remember your problem. What does that sound like? See, you were insignificant. You know, I didn't remember that. So you kind of have to stand there and act like you remember when you don't, and try to get enough information, you know, to do this. But it come up and they'll say this. And I remember the one of the last times it happened not too long ago. A lady came up I hadn't seen for 2 or 3 or 4 years. She said, "Oh Lowell, I'm so glad to see you." And she turned around. A guy said, "This guy totally turned my life around." Said he just totally saved my life. I saved her life. I didn't even remember talking to her. See? And she turned around and said something about saying, "Remember when you came in and that advice that you gave me?" And I was hoping I could remember because it's bound to be good stuff, you know. But I could not remember. And she turned and said, "Yeah." Said, "He told me, you know," said, "he pointed out about 3 or 4 things that I ought to do. And I went back and I did it exactly that way." And she said, "Today I own my own house. I've got a good job. I'm happy. I'm contented. My kids are got good mental health." And she started talking about it. And boy, I wish I had all of that stuff, see, in there. But now, she attributed it all to me. Now, I've got sense enough. No, she's the one who put it in practice, see. But what I'm getting at is, it kind of shakes me up, you know, to think, here is a conversation I heard had with this girl. She's in her old, probably 20, 25, 28 when I talked with her. You know, and I had a conversation with her. And I had so much power because she went out and did everything I said. Now, if I'd have given her some bad advice, what would have happened? See? And it kind of scares you, see, when you do that. And so you hear people come back and they say these things and you don't even remember what you said, but boy, they will take this advice and put it into practice. There is power in there. So you're dealing with that, see? Now, as you're dealing with that, last week we were talking about, when do you give advice? When do you say, here's what you ought to do? Now, we talk about there are times that you need to do it. In what I would call abnormal counseling. When somebody says, "I'm going to kill myself," was the illustration that was given. Now it's time to, you know, to give some advice. Don't do this. Do this. Let's talk about this and so forth. But that is abnormal counseling. Now, in regular counseling, really, where you're talking about it here, I think maybe that you could break it down in this realm. I haven't thought a lot about it this week, but this afternoon just hit me and I looked at my notes here, the things I'm going to talk about. I say, okay, what is the guideline of when I feel free to give advice? And now there are times when I say, okay, now take notes, sit down. Let me tell you something. You listen now. Now, when do I do that? All right? It's at times that the decision will not be made on emotions. I think that's a pretty good way of putting it. The decision will not be made on emotions. Now, let me illustrate. A person comes in and talks to me tomorrow about selling their house. Let's suppose that that they say, I really think I ought to sell my house. I really think I should. But I just don't know whether I can depart from that house or not. Now, I know it would be the best investment. I mean, look here. I could take this, and I could take the equity, and I could put it in here, and I could do this, and I could do that. Yeah, sure could. But and I could move over here in this place for half the price. Yeah, sure could. I don't know whether to be happy. I'm not sure whether to be happy. What do you think I ought to do, Lowell? Now, what's the answer?
That feels like to me that there's a lot of strong emotional.
There's emotion. We've got both of them, don't we? We've got facts. It's a fact. You ought to sell your house. Financially speaking, sell it. I mean, you're at this age. You need the money and all this. Sell your house. See? Let's take a woman 60 years of age and her husband dies. So she got all this equity built up in the home and she sells it. She can travel the world. You know, she can do whatever she wants to do. If she doesn't sell it, she's going to have to go to work and work 4 or 5 hours a day. What's the smart thing to do? See, she's got something wrong with her physically where she doesn't think she can stand on her feet. Well, sell the house, use the equity, move over here. Then if you want to go to work to keep from being lonesome or something, go do it. See, I mean, the facts are just out there. But what if I say, I'd sell your house. Sell your house and move over. Now, what's going to happen? She sells her house, moves over, and then unhappy when that's replaced. See? It's going to come back to me. Now, it's not so bad that it would come back to me. However, that would be bad if everybody I talked to hated me. You see, because I told them what they ought to do, and maybe everything I said was right. I never, ever make a mistake. 100% right. It'll all come back, see, and hate on here if there's any emotion that's tied in to that situation. But it makes them accept the responsibility themselves. And then when they make that decision and they move over, it'll make them like that new house better. Do you see the point? So you guide them into the facts, but don't make that decision for them. Now, what happens? Let's say this same individual comes in, or another individual comes in, and said, okay, we got all this equity over here, you know, $500,000 equity in this house, and I could sell this, I could move over here, and I said, well, how do you feel about selling the house? Oh, the house really has no meaning to me, no feelings, but I want to make sure that I'm doing the proper thing financially. You know, I don't want to make a financial mistake in here. And I want to do this. And so I see that there's no attachment that is in there. And so they say, I think what I'll do is, I've got $500,000 equity in this house. I think I'll rent it out. I get $1,000 a month. Now what would you say? See? Now you need to say, let's do some talking. See? Let's do some talking. Now here is what I would advise you to do. Something. Now you can start giving advice. And you can't tell what they're going to have to do, but here's what I would advise you to do. Lay it out somewhat like a financial advisor would do. Here would be my suggestion, but you could do this or you could do this. Here's your pros and cons. Here's what I think would be the best, but you do what you want to do. And you're going to have to let that depend on the capability of the person in making decisions. Now, in the one that we're after right now, how many times would a woman, let's say 60 years of age, never worked outside the home, have a good concept of any kind of financial investments? Hardly any. You see that they would do that. Now, what I like to do in dealing with that is not tell them where to put the money, but to have a little education along the line. In other words, have one session just education. Okay, let's just sit down and talk about education. Let's just talk about money. Now, here it is. You can do this, you can do this, you can do this. And here's what this means, here's what this means. And if you do this, here's what it'll do. And you can do this, and then take your calculator and show them what the money will turn into and so forth. And then, what I do then is call in a financial advisor. them, and somebody, you know, that I've got some confidence in. Sit down with them, sit there, listen, and let them present the situation, try to guide them along that line. But what I'm getting at, I think that you see the point in there, that if it is an emotional situation, make sure that you guide them into making their own decisions. See, make sure that you do that. Otherwise, it won't work. If it's just black and white, well, then of course a person can do that. Now, while we're on this thing of emotions, and while we're in Psalms or Proverbs, I want to talk a little bit here tonight about the feeling, the emotional feeling that people have when they find that their mate is unfaithful. And this is something that you have to accept. You have to wrestle. You just have to accept it. That this is the way that it is. There is a difference between a man and a woman. First of all, we're going to read about the man in the Bible. You don't read about the woman, her feelings in there. But when a woman finds out that her husband is unfaithful, it's devastating to her. And her first expression as she comes to you may be, I just want to get a divorce. I just want to get a divorce. I want to get out of this whole thing. That's what I want to do. I can never live with him again. Or it may be, I just don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And she can't talk rationally. It's just like somebody came in and said your husband died. You know, I mean, the emotional shock that is in there. Now, when this happens, whatever they say, don't write it down and say, this is what they're going to do. In other words, if she comes in and says, I'm leaving, I'm moving out, I'm going, you know, I never speak to him again, I hate him, I'm going to do this, and then they get up and leave, just act as though those words, you never heard those words. Because the next time you talk to her, it will change. See? And it does that all the time. It'll do it all the time. The next time she comes back, it'll generally come back. She'll say, I just don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do. Well, how do you feel that the last time you said that you were just going to leave and divorce him? Is that still your plans? No, I ought to. I don't know. I just, what do you think I ought to do? What would you do? What she would like for you to do at this time is to give her the answer. And then she can solve the problem and then go home and be happy. But it won't work that way. See, either way that you say it. Now, she is going to be in this I don't know what to do stage. What I encourage them to do is take time to think about it. Take time to think. And let your emotions settle down before you make your final decision. And it may be that you can work this thing out and you can have a happy marriage. It may be that you can't. I don't know. This is going to have to be your decision. Now, she's going to come back. And as she comes back, it's going to depend to a great extent on the man's attitude. And generally speaking, where there is adultery, there's a lot of other problems. And these other problems are going to become involved in this thing. That he's not treated her right financially. He's maybe slapped her around. He has mistreated her in some way. It's very seldom that you find two happily married people. The man has treated the wife just the way he should treat her, and then he commits adultery. I mean, adultery doesn't happen that way. That's not the way that it comes in. Wherever there's adultery, there's other problems that are involved. Now, she's going to be thinking about these things, and then she's going to go through a period of thinking, I can get rid of him and get married and have a happy life. And that's what I'm going to get rid of. All my problems. And maybe the next time she comes in, I have made up my mind. I'm divorcing. I'm leaving him. I'm going to get rid of all my problems. I'm leaving him. And if you talk with her a little while, it may be that it'll come up. She'll say, yeah, I said, the other day I had coffee with this fella, and it was kind of fun. What does that tell you? See, it's getting more complicated now. As she is doing some things she shouldn't do, you're going to have to give her some guidance there. Now's not coffee time. You see, we're working on this problem and before we do this. But I'm telling you the way that these things happen. Because she will start looking at what a great thing it would be to be single. Now, why would she think it would be a great thing to be single? Why would she go through that stage?
Because it's so bad to be married.
It's so bad to be married. She has gone through all of this misery. So she'd be single. She could go back and she could go through the courting process again. And then she could get the right guy, Mr. Right, and so live happily ever after. And so it seems like it's a solution to her problem. Now, again, if you did say at this time, divorce the guy. I would too. I'd divorce him. She wouldn't. You see, she's not ready. But, of course, you don't say that. You say, well, if that's your decision, now I want you to think about certain things. And that's when I tell them then what they're going to run across if they get a divorce. And I want them to see both sides of the coin. Now, if you stay with this guy, you're going to have problems. And I sit down and we write down the problems that you're going to have. What are some of the problems you're going to have? You make up your mind you're going to stay with him. What are some of the problems you're going to have?
You won't trust him.
You're not going to trust him. Okay. How long is it going to take you to trust him?
Never.
Maybe never. But it's going to be a long period of time before you're going to trust him. Every time he's late, you're going to wonder. Every time money's missing, that he said, I don't know what I did with that. $20 or $30? I don't know. You know, I must have bought a part for the car or something. You're going to be thinking about these things. So you're going to have all that trust, lack of trust. What else? What other things we get? By the way, that's the biggest thing right there. You going to have any sexual problems? What are you going to think about every time that you be on your mind? I wonder if he's thinking of her. And then, are you going to question him? I know you're going to make your vows. And you're going to say, we're going to let the past be the past. But are you? What's it going to feel like? See, when in here. Are you going to ask him? And so I point out a lot of problems that they're going to have. Now, the biggest one is going to be lack of trust. And this is why some marriage counselors just say it's almost totally impossible to put a marriage back together once adultery has been committed, because the trust has been shattered, and when the trust is shattered, the marriage will never go back together. Now, it can be. But I tell you that because it is so hard to put it back. It is so hard. Because when adultery has been committed, every aspect of that marriage has been shattered. It's like me coming into your home, taking a precious vase that you've got, dropping it on the cement floor, and saying, boy, I'm sorry. Now, can you put it back together? Well, yeah, you can put it back together. I'll send a guy over tomorrow to put it back together. So he'll come over. He'll put it back together. But what kind of vase will you have? It's not too good a chance it's going to be like it was before. Now, every aspect of your marriage is shattered when that lack of trust is in there. And there's nothing that does it like adultery. So, this woman then is going to go through this. I'm going to divorce him, and then I'm going to keep him, and then I'm just going to divorce him. And she's going to go through periods of elation, dreaming about going out and courting and getting married again. And this is the wrong basis on which to make her decision. And you're going to have to constantly guide her in there. Then finally, when it comes down to the point, let's suppose that the guy has no redeeming value about him. Suppose you can't think of any good thing about this guy. I mean, he's been a liar. He's been an alcoholic. He's been a cheat. He has committed adultery on various occasions. He still is lying. You catch him in lies, open, outright lies. You can't think of any good thing about him. He pulled her away from the Lord when they were married, and now then he's trying to go back to church some. They always start going back and really get more religious then. But then you start checking, and then they start dropping out. And really, you can't find any, and she can't find any. And you ask her, you say, well, tell me one way, tell me one thing he could do to enhance your life if you took him back. Name me one way he could enhance you. And can't. Some of them say, well, money. But some of them have already got a job. Nothing. Because I'm getting along better now with my job than I was when he was taking my money. Spiritually, I feel better than I've ever felt in my life. There's nothing. There's no way. Well, why don't you divorce him? Well, now guess what's going to be? Here's your next one. Every time, 100%. It'll never.
Still love him.
Well, okay, I still love him. That comes in a lot. Is I still love him. And so, well, why do you love him and so forth? But that's not the big one. The big one that they really have to wrestle with is guilt. If I do divorce him, I'll cause him to go out and commit adultery again, and you know he'll probably fall away from the Lord, and I'll be responsible for him going to hell. And so his life, his happiness, and his life, and his salvation, everything depends on me. Now, you stop to think how that woman would feel, and she feels this way. How would you like to feel that about any particular individual? Suppose I told you about some individual tonight we're going to give you an assignment to. And his happiness, his life, his marriage, his salvation, his faithfulness, everything depends on you. And if he fails in any one of them, you're going to be held responsible. How would you like that? Wouldn't that be a horrible feeling? Now, that's the way this woman is going to feel. Men don't have that feeling like women do. But women will have that feeling. Now, then they even have it to the point of where if they get a divorce, if the guy comes in and says, look, I'm divorcing you. There's nothing you're going to do about it. I'm going to divorce you. And goes to court. Do you know what she'll do when she goes to court unless you counsel her what to do? When they go to court and try to make the financial arrangements, you know how much money she'll tell him, the judge she wants? He says, well, sir, I'm not interested in his money. I don't want his money. Just enough to, you know, for the kids to get by on. And so that's what he'll give her. You know, I know of one lady that raised her children on $35 a month. That's what it was, $35 a month. And didn't want the money. Every one of them does that. And here's the thing that frustrates me. When I sit down with a woman and I tell her, now look, here's what this guy's done to you. I mean, you have every right in the world to do this. And he has done this. And don't you be easy. He owes you, and he owes the children financial support. Now, you stick with your guns. Well, I just don't feel like, you know, I just makes me feel bad. He wouldn't have enough to do the things he likes to do. And if he doesn't like to, I mean, he likes to hunt and fish and ski in the winter. And if he'd be very unhappy if he couldn't do it. He couldn't do them if he gave me, you know, a lot of money. Still worrying, you see, about him. And you get them to say, okay, I'll do it. And they go in court and they won't do it. That's how bad it is. So keep that in mind that you go through that guilt process then with them. And then they will again want you to make the decision for them. What would you do? What do you think I should do? You know. And finally, it will become as clear as a bell to you after a while. Either they're not going to get a divorce and just talking about it, or they are going to get a divorce, you know, and just talking about not. It becomes clear, but you're going to have to just go ahead and guide them through and let them make up their mind. Because if they don't make up their own mind, you guide them scripturally. Make sure that they don't make scriptural errors. But that's the way that a woman will react. Now, when she forgives a fellow, if If he will treat her nice, she then can get over this much easier than a man. A man's ego is as fragile as anything can possibly be. And I want you to turn to Proverbs chapter 4. In Proverbs chapter 4, I don't want 4, I want 6. Yeah, Proverbs chapter 6. In Proverbs chapter 6, let's talk here about what wisdom says. This is what God says now to a man. All right. He starts out down in verse 24. Proverbs 6:24. It says, "You're to listen to all this instruction to keep thee from the evil woman, from the flattery of the foreigner's tongue." Does a woman's tongue have any effect on a man? The way she talks, how she talks, the sound of her voice, what she says? Why, of course, it does. Now, you get the wisdom, so you're not led by that. And then it says, to keep thee from the evil woman, from the flattery of the foreigner's tongue, lust not after her beauty in thy heart. Just like Jesus, right? In other words, don't start lusting after a woman's beauty. Now, what does that mean when you lust after a woman? Does that mean that you look at a woman and you see that she is beautiful, just tremendously beautiful, sexually attractive? Is that what that means? That's not what that means. If let me ask you guys a question. Suppose that suppose I have $1 million up here stacked up, and I say, "Now I want you to look at this $1 million. What are you thinking? Are you thinking there's $10,000 there? Are you thinking there's $1 million there?" That's what you're thinking. $1 million. Would you like to have it? I mean, have you come to the point that you see $1 million? You say, "Boy, I'm glad I don't have that stuff. You know, I won't go work for mine. Hope Lowell doesn't give that to me." I mean, that's where you get. No. No. Boy. Man, if I had $1 million, I could pay off all my debts. I'd solve my problems. Wish I had that. Sure, that's what you think about. Is that lusting after money?
No.
That's not lusting after money. Huh? See, that's not lusting after. Now, suppose I leave the money right here, and you're looking at it, and you think, "Boy, that would do it." Now, lust means strong desire. You have a strong desire. Now, you're going to look upon it to lust after it. That's what it says. You're looking upon this money with a strong desire for it. And so you're thinking, "Man, yeah, how can I get that away from him? I hope he forgets it. If old Lowell forgets that money tonight, like he does a lot of things, and he goes home, I'll go home and then tonight I'll come up and punch in the code and all." Now, are you lusting? Yeah, now you're lusting. Now, I may take my money and go home, and you don't get to take it, but you've sinned. See, you've committed a crime. You've committed a crime of thievery in your mind. Now, you look at a beautiful woman. Who can look at a beautiful woman and think she's an elephant? Or look at a beautiful woman and think she's a slide projector? You don't. What do you think when you see a beautiful woman? She's a beautiful woman. That's what you think. See, she's a beautiful woman. And now, what's the difference then in seeing she is a beautiful woman, and since she is a woman and she's beautiful, she would be sexually attractive to you if you have any sexual desires at all. When does it turn into lust?
When you start planning the
day. When you start looking at her like that money. Huh. Boy, I'd like to have her. And you start doing this. Now, when should you quit looking at my $1 million? When should you quit looking at it?
It becomes a problem, I guess.
When you see it starts to become a problem with you. See, if it's going to become a problem with you, are you not able to look at this $1 million the way that you should? When should you quit looking at the woman? In other words, what I'm trying to say is, you don't just look and say, "Oh, there's a pretty woman. I can't." It's a sin. God said it's a sin if a man sees a pretty woman. Now, I emphasize this because this is the general concept that men have, generally, really, of looking at a woman. That's not what it's saying. Lust not after her beauty in thy heart. See? Don't work it over in your heart. Start making plans, desires. Maybe you're not making plans because you're a coward, but you would if you could because you really want to. You see? Get it under your control. All right. So what he says is, don't let the tongue work on you. Don't let her looks work on you. Neither let her take you with the eyelids. Eyelids have anything to do with the attraction of a woman? Why, sure they do. Set for on the count of a harlot, a man is brought to a piece of bread. Now here is what we need to understand happens in this case. On the count of a harlot, a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress hunted for the precious life. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Pretty good way of putting it. Is it possible for me to come to your house and you've got your fireplace going, I walk over, take the coals out of the fireplace, stick them up on my chest, wrap them up here in my arm, carry them out, throw them out, come back in and not have any burns? Not have any smoke smells. If I do that, I'm going to get burned. Now what he's saying is, just as surely as you do that, just that surely, if you commit adultery, your life is going to have problems. He said, or can one walk upon hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So he that goeth in to his neighbor's wife, whosoever toucheth her shall not be unpunished. Now, the idea of touching, that word is a word meaning sexual activity. It doesn't mean that you shake her hand or you put your hand on her shoulder or something of a friendly nature that we all do every once in a while. It's not that touching. It's the same thing in the Bible. And he knew his wife. Well, of course he knew his wife. He had to know her. He couldn't have married her, right? No, that's the word no means, see, sexual activity. Now, that's what touch means here. Now, whosoever then commits adultery with his neighbor's wife shall not be unpunished. Men do not despise a thief if he steal to satisfy himself when he is hungry. But if he be found, he shall restore sevenfold. He shall give all the substance of his house. Now, here's just an illustration. If somebody is caught stealing, and you find out the reason that they're stealing is because they are really hungry, do you hate them? We lived way back in the country when I was a boy, 12 miles out of town. And there was another family that lived 13 miles. They lived on back in the woods farther than we did. And so they were poorer than what we were. And I mean, they were really poor. They starved. We didn't. But there would be times when we would leave at night and we would come home and a loaf of bread would be gone. Now, I remember my dad and mom talking about that. Do you suppose that we hated those people for breaking into the house and stealing a loaf of bread? Mm-mm. No, they didn't hate them at all. See, and in fact, the next day they'd take food over to them or something. But what he's saying here is that a thief, when a thief is caught, legally speaking, nobody hates them because they were providing food, but they have to pay the price. See, they have to pay the price. Now, if a person like that has to pay the price, what about somebody who commits adultery? 32. He that committeth adultery with a woman is void of understanding. He doeth it who would destroy his own soul. Now that doesn't mean that I say, you know, I think I want to destroy my soul. How do I do it? Oh, I'll go commit adultery. That doesn't mean that's the reason. The guy makes up his mind. What it does mean is this, that if I commit adultery, I am the kind of fella who will destroy my soul. I do not put the price of my soul high enough so that it will not be destroyed. I'll sell out my soul. That's the idea that is here. Now, if you do it, you're that kind of a fella, you're going to destroy your soul. Wounds and dishonor shall he get, and his reproach shall not be wiped away. Now, 34 is a very important verse. For jealousy is the rage of a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not regard any ransom, neither will he rest content, though thou givest many gifts. So an individual goes over and commits adultery with another man's wife. You are going to pay for it the rest of your life. And when her wife finds out about it, you're really going to pay for it. I mean, when her husband finds out about it, you're really going to pay for it. Because what he says here is that there's something about a man. Jealousy is the rage of a man. And there's no way to put it out. Now, you can go to that fella and you can say, I'm sorry I committed adultery with your wife. And here, I'll give you $1 million and write him out a check. I'm sorry. And he'll hate you. And he may take your $1 million and then spend it in getting you killed. Trying to do something to you. Now the reason I went through this is to show the extreme repercussions of where adultery is committed. What to expect in a man. Now, if a man has committed adultery, you're going to have to watch out for the other woman's husband. There's going to be repercussions that are going to come into play. And many times, they try to kill. And other times, try to maim. And other times, try to do other things. But that jealousy is so deep that no telling what's going to happen. Now, suppose that somebody comes in and it's the woman who has committed adultery. And now then you're dealing here with the brethren here. In other words, brother and sister here, she's committed adultery. How's this man going to feel? You're dealing with the adulteress. Are you going to have any problem with her husband? And you're going to have a whole set of new problems than you would if it were turned around the other way. That's why I was talking about the woman, the way she reacts first. Now then, the man doesn't react that way. The man reacts in rage. And so you're going to have to deal with him then in a whole new set of ways. He will mistreat his wife. He'll try to kill the other guy. He'll try to maim the other guy. He'll try to do something to the other guy. Scare him to death. Over and over and over again, make him pay for what he's done, and all this hatred will be going through his mind, and you're going to have to deal with it in that way. So adultery is not just a little thing. Adultery is something that ruins the lives of people, and the people that put them back together again are the people that have to go through this whole thing to just almost in an unbelievable way. Anything anybody wants to talk about on this?
Just a question, refresh your memory. I think maybe you talked about this once. Is there ever a time that a person comes in and you say, let's not tell the husband or the wife? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there are, and that will happen quite often. The question is, the man or the woman comes in and says, I've committed adultery. What do I do? If I tell my wife, she'll be totally devastated. If I don't tell her, then she will never know what has happened. And so this is a question that everybody in the world that deals with counseling has to wrestle with. There are two schools of thought on it. Both of them are very firm in their position. One of them is, do not tell. And here's the reason they say, do not tell. And that is that if you tell, then you are going to throw this whole load over on the other shoulders and ruin their life as long as they live. See, as long as they're married to you. And do you want to do that? In other words, you've committed the sin. Now, do you want to throw your load over on Pam and ruin her life the rest of her life? Or would it be best not to tell her and then she can live happily the rest of her life? A pretty good argument, right? Now, do you know why you would want to tell her? And probably will. And if I said, Steve, don't tell her, and you said, okay, I'm not going to tell her, you probably will in 3 or 4 years. Know why?
She's sinned against her.
What?
You sinned against her.
Huh? I couldn't live with it myself.
There it is. You can't
believe the guilt that he feels.
The guilt. That's right. The guilt that you have until you tell her and confess it to her because you have sinned against her, It's just going to tear up your mind. Just riddle it to pieces. And the chances are you're going to break down in 2 or 3 years and say, I have to tell you something. Now, when you tell her, it's going to do just what I said a minute ago. It's just going to devastate her, and it will affect her for life. It'll make you feel a whole lot better. Now, here is the problem of a man now in doing this. Unless you're really sensitive. You know, I mean, I'm not talking about a real, wise, God-fearing person. But after all, how many of them go out and commit adultery? They're not the majority that do it. Now, here is probably is what generally happens. You throw it on Pam. Pam, here's what I did. It rid you of your guilt. And now you go away happy. And now she's got the problem. Then, in a week or two, she's still moping around. Got the problem. Doesn't want to have sexual relations with you. Just like this. And you're going to get her. What's wrong with you, woman? It's been 2 weeks. And, you're going to have to handle that problem. Well, and start, because you're free. You have relieved your guilt. Now, I know it doesn't sound like that's the way that a man would work, but that is the way that it works so often. Then you magnify it. See? Then she comes in. She's going to say, Steve can't understand why I can't forget it. We're back together. He says, we're back together. I love you. I treat you better now than I ever did. What's your problem? And there's a big problem in there. See? Now, the other side, one says, don't tell. The other side says, do tell. Because for two reasons. Well, really for 3 reasons. Number one is your guilt. Number two is that you're probably going to tell her later anyway, because that you can't handle it. And number three is that you're going to ruin her life. You know, that is in there. So go ahead and tell her right now. To get your life straightened out. You're not going to be able to be normal until you do. Some of these days you're going to tell her, and then she's going to say, why didn't you tell me then? And you deceived me all these years. And it'll be worse. So go ahead and tell her now. And you see, get it over. There's the big problem. If we were wise enough to look and see how Pam would handle this, if I could look ahead and say, well, if you tell her, Pam will be devastated for a couple of weeks, but then she'll forgive you. You've had a good marriage, and you'll put it back together again. And so why ruin her life? Don't tell her. See? If I could look ahead and see that, then I say, don't tell her. On the other hand, if I could look ahead and say, 2 years from now, you're going to be going to a psychiatrist, and you're going to tell her, and then the marriage is going to break up, then I'd say, tell her. See? Then there's one other thing that bothers me in this, of where I'm really not going to tell you whether to tell her or not. Is I want to give you both sides of the coin on this thing. But one thing that bothers me is, if I say, no, don't tell her, you have committed a sin. It is against her. It is of such a nature that she now has the God-given right to divorce you and remarry. It's how bad it is. You have committed something that God says is so bad that's adulterated that marriage and gives her the right to bring it up and remarry. Now that's bad. And she has that right. Now she has the right to make up that mind, not me. See? And I would feel awful guilty of telling you, don't tell her. And then you guys living together for 20 years, and then she finds out about it. Then she comes to me and says, who do you think you are? You know, I wouldn't have lived with him that long if I'd known that. Never would I have lived with him, you see, in this way. I took the prerogative of making the decision that belongs to her. So I can't do that. Now, on the other hand, I can't just urge you to run home and tell her real fast because of what it's going to heap on her. I have found that generally where you give, like if we're acting as though this were you, give you both sides of the case, you talk about it, and then I tell you, think about it. Come back and talk to me again. Generally speaking, the man will come to a proper decision if you're really trying to work on it. Probably come to a proper decision. That is your generally telling them. But it's a toughie.
Mm-hmm. Carry your concern a little bit further. And in the spiritual realm, could the man stand before God in a forgiven sense without the offended wife knowing?
That's the next step.
That's my next question.
Yeah, see. I don't know. That's tough to answer. Because of this other, if he says, I suppose if a man says, I truly repent, I will tell her if I should, but if I don't, I'll carry the burden myself. If I shouldn't, I'll carry the burden myself. And if he's really a God-fearing person, and if he really, truly believes that he can save his life, his wife, a life of tragedy, he will carry the burden himself. He probably could, but I don't know. I'm using probablys now that's in there. No, it's a good question. That's where we can't put ourselves up as the final judge, because we are going to have to stand before him.
You know the scripture of Matthew 18, where it talks about the person who has received an offense from somebody else. Mm-hmm. The responsibility is very clearly laid out there, that the offended person has the responsibility to go to the one who has done that and try to resolve it. Mm-hmm. Do you know any scripture that's parallel to that, that addresses to the offender and his or her responsibility? No, I know that I've done something wrong. Is there a scripture that tells me specifically what I need to do to help resolve it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I never thought about that question. I don't know one. Anybody know one?
I don't either. It would be really nice to have one.
It sure would.
Because then you could resolve that issue that we're talking about here. Uh-huh. You tell the person, here's what such and such a scripture says about what your responsibility as the offender in this,
yeah,
in this situation.
Yeah. You know, if you know that your brother has aught against you, you know, and you're at the altar, leave the gift and go talk to him, but that's the case. Pam doesn't have anything against Steve. In this particular case, this is an unusual situation. Is he's committed the greatest crime he could commit against her. And I think probably, I don't know whether murder would be worse, less or worse, but, you know, really, seriously. Committed the greatest crime he could commit, and to devastate her. And boy, it's a big question. I don't know. I don't have the answer.
It just seems like it would be hard in my mind to think of eternity and view eternity and say, I'm going to take that chance. Mm-hmm. I realize that maybe you're going to devastate somebody's life on this earth, but still both of you would have the chance to go to heaven. And it seems like a chance that...
Okay, now, I think what we're talking about right now here shows the situation. You remember I said if we talked, I'd send you home, think about it a week, and you come back, what would your answer be? See, the way you're talking. See, you know, I've got to spend eternity. I'm going to devastate her. But then you start weighing these things. And your comments came over here, you see. And that's what I'm saying, that you generally come to the right decision, and that is, tell her. And I think that's generally the proper thing.
Just one other thing. I mean, just sitting here and listening to the soberness of the sin, it's adultery and so on, and it just... It kind of enthused me to say, why don't we get up in the pulpit and preach on it a little more, or make everybody a little more aware of the consequences of it and so on. Maybe you've approached that or thought about it. But.
Well, yeah, I've thought about it, and then when I try, I do bring it up. But there's something different in a class like this than there is in sermons. You know, and people really taking the seriousness of it. But I brought up the point really several times in sermons, but there's still something different. Because, see, then you're sitting there and you're not thinking about yourself. When I bring up adultery and when you do this and that, that's out of your ballpark, so your mind going somewhere else while I'm talking to those adulterers. You know, and we do that whether we know it or not. Okay, time's up. Now, next week, make sure that you bring this one right here on how to begin a session, because we're going to, I want to deal with that one this next time. Okay, class dismissed.